Welcome to Red Meat, the conservative news update you need from Odyssey stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in. Today marks the 25th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, which, to repurpose a great man's quote, is a day that will live in infamy. So, did we learn enough? Here's Tommy Tucker in New Orleans.
Anniversary of 9/11, the 25th anniversary. David Chancer joins us now, our friend, professor of public policy at Duke University. The whole country has changed in 25 years, and even your approach with students when you talk about this with them.
Well, we have to, of course, teach them what it was like to be here on that day. And I do. I start my class by actually having them watch the Today Show, and they move from a cooking segment to coverage of 9/11. And, of course, there was confusion after the plane hit the first tower. Nobody knew really what was happening. And then, of course, that you see the live on TV, the plane actually steered intentionally into the second tower. And it's clear after that that, America's been attacked, and it's an act of, mass murder and terrorism. And the whole mood of the country and really the world changed. And while I don't think you can trace everything that is happening in our world today to 9/11, I think 9/11 has impacted the trajectory of history in many significant ways.
How so?
I think it's affected America. And America, America was the predominant superpower, the sole global superpower in 2001. And we had a swagger about ourselves and a great deal of confidence about our mission, our trajectory in the world to, spread democracy, to use our power to promote peace and prosperity around the world. And I really think, because of 9/11 and because of the way some of the policies we pursued in response to 9/11 turned out, mainly the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also kind of our failure to prevent ISIS from becoming such a powerful destructive force, and many other things. I feel like we've lost our national confidence and in some way our sense of the American mission in the world. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about that in our society today, a lot of tension, a lot of anger in many ways. And I think that shapes our very politics that we see in our country today. So, Bin Laden, these were not what his intentions were. His intention was to get us out of the U.S., out of the Middle East, so he could pursue an Islamist revolution of sorts there. But I think he did, maybe unintentionally, impose a pretty bad blow on the American psyche.
Do you think there's any way they could have, these 19 people, or is there any historical precedent for 19 people causing such a change in the world?
Wow. I'd have to think hard about that one. Certainly nothing directly comes to mind. Of course, they were, had some help, some strategic help in planning, but mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda was a small organization. And look at what it invoked. It invoked the greatest superpower in the world to go to, in the history of the world, really, to go to war in many places, to change its entire approach to the world, to change its foreign policy, to change its internal domestic laws. That's a lot. You're right.
And its economy as well.
It was an economic blow. We did recover. I don't think you can say the Great Recession of 2008 was caused by Al-Qaeda, but, and by some estimates, the Brown Cost of War, and I'm not saying it's entirely accurate, but it's an amazing report. They estimate that the 9/11 and its aftermath and its policies have cost the American taxpayer $8 trillion.
Consequential, yeah. He said 25 years later and we're still at war with terrorism. What has changed? That's a blanket question, but I'd like to hear your answer.
Well, this movement that Bin Laden started, he didn't really start, he advanced it, that the idea that the West was at war with the Muslim people and that therefore Muslim people, what he believed, the holy religious Muslim people should strike back at the West. Really has not gone very well. It's kind of fizzled. And so in many respects, you know, our post 9/11 efforts in that regard have been successful. Very few people still believe these ideas, and fewer are willing to die for them. Now, ISIS is still rampaging in a number of countries around the world. But I think if we look at that measure, you know, that has been successful. I think but the other thing that has changed was this idea that the United States launching a global war on terrorism and then encompassing so many different aspects of our foreign policy into that frame of war. And that war, I think, if you look at it in totality, has imposed more costs on the United States than benefits. So we did a lot right on counterterrorism, but a lot wrong in the war on terror.
When it comes to our biggest enemies now, is it ISIS? Is it Al-Qaeda? Is it somebody else? The Houthis? Who is it?
Well, I think if you look at, you know, terrorist groups that advance this radical Islamist ideology, yeah, ISIS is the most powerful and most widespread group. Al-Qaeda still exists, but is really a shell of its former self.
I'm making some notes here. I'm sorry. So where do you see us 25 years from now?
Well, you know, Tommy, our biggest challenges come from other places, both other areas in the world and other issues. Obviously, the competition with China over whether we're going to try to have a capitalist, democratic future in the world or their kind of controlled economy system, state communism, that is going to be the great challenge of the next 25 years. Of course, climate change, everybody understands it's happening and how we're going to grapple with it. And of course, how is AI going to change our world? These are the huge challenges of the next 25 years. But of course, you just, as well as the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. So I think if you take those four issues, that's what's going to shape the next 25 years. But the problem is that these issues of violence, sporadic but intense violence that come out of nowhere that you don't expect. That's what happened on September 11th. It was this beautiful day and the world was one, and then it was different once this had happened. These kinds of events happen and do change the course of history. So even if we think those are the four issues that are going to shape the course of the next 25 years, we might get diverted by something else.
They were probing. They found a weakness. Are people still probing, and are there still weaknesses to be found?
Sure. We know there's no such thing as perfect security, Tommy, but I think by and large, we've done a pretty good job if you look at the record in terms of preventing Al-Qaeda or ISIS-related terrorism here inside the United States.
Here's more from the Mark Cox Show.
You are king, and you find out that there are 30 million uninvited people in your country. What do you do with them?
Oh, in this case, I try to find the most humane way of sending them back to our country. But first of all, I want to say...
That's what we're doing.
Wait, let me just say something.
That's what we're doing.
Let me just say
King
something.
King Claudio.
Griff Jenkins.
Watch your back. On a daily basis, not weekly, daily basis, I get a press release from ICE every day talking about criminals that were removed from communities. And so I thought it was good that the convention's leaning into that. I'm not sure if it's going to be enough, but... it is certainly worth remembering that the last 4 years made this country far more dangerous and at risk of all sorts of horrible things, not only the possibility of a future terrorist attack, but also the fact that particularly immigrant communities daily are dealing with these murders, rapists, and criminals.
You know, a lot of people, Griff, are asking Zohran Mamdani to stay away from any sort of 9/11 memorial service tomorrow. And from everything I've seen, it sounds like he said, well, I'm planning to go, despite you guys telling me that. I have to imagine he'll show up, people will boo him to the point where it's pointless for him to be there. And then he'll get off the stage and basically say, look, I tried, but they didn't want me there.
For the life of me, I don't understand why he wants to bring this on himself. I don't see any scenario, to your point, Kim, where he looks like he's coming out on top. And even if he wanted to try and, let's say, repair his image, particularly amongst those that were most affected by 9/11, the families and victims. He should have been doing it from day one when he took office. Instead, what do we have last week? He literally hands a pen, after signing a 9/11 commemoration executive order, hands the pen to his police commissioner, Jessica Tisch, who then is forced to hand it to his attorney, who, as we all now know, literally defended an al-Qaeda terrorist. And that al-Qaeda terrorist, which was but arrested for a 2002 event, his brother-in-law was among the hijackers on the American Airlines 77 that crashed in the Pentagon. It's an undeniable, horrible look.
Yeah. Take us back to that day, Griff. What was your role with Fox at the time? What were you doing?
I was Ollie North's producer. We were doing war stories at the time and a radio show of his. And my daughter was 12 days old, born on August 31st. I was taking some time off, holding my baby, watching Fox and Friends, when I saw planes hitting the Twin Towers. And I thought, oh, my gosh, here we go. And I knew Colonel North was out of town. He'd been making a speech, was flying back. And I wasn't sure if I should go in, even though I'm on dad leave, parent leave for a few days.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, was only a few days back then.
That's right.
But then I think it was a BlackBerry in those days, whatever, my first-generation mobile phone rings. And it's Colonel North calling me from when airplanes could take a credit card and make a really crappy connection call from the actual seat. And he was like, we just flew over DCA. I see the Pentagon's hit. I hadn't even seen the Pentagon thing yet. And I live, 2 miles from it. And he's like, I'm landing. They're rerouting us to Dulles. Get into the office. Let's go. Colonel North ended up getting a little bit of a police escort, if you will, to get in the city because the city was emptying. And at the time I had a moped. I saw the gridlock and the chaos, and I jumped on my moped and drove into work. And I don't think I left work after another 40 hours from the coverage. Colonel North got in. For years after, Mark, he would give speeches and hold up the boarding pass that he had from that flight as they flew over, and he caught a glimpse, obviously, because the Pentagon is so close to DCA, Reagan National Airport now, that he, talks about it. So it takes me back 25 years, and now I'm headed to New York in a few hours because tomorrow I'll be reporting from the Yankee Stadium where they're doing a 25-year anniversary of that game where, of course, President George W. Bush threw out the first pitch just weeks after.
Yeah.
For those of you who are new to the world, Mohammed Atta was an Egyptian militant Islamist and al-Qaeda operative who helped plot and lead the September 11th attacks. He led the team of hijackers who took control of American Airlines Flight 11 and flew it into the North Tower of New York City's World Trade Center. Tara Servatius has thoughts on his legacy.
Lee, it's one of the most obscure documents around 9/11, and I don't know why. Great piece in Tablet this morning, what Mohammed Atta was trying to tell us. A full 5 years before the 9/11 attack, the key 9/11 attacker, Mohammed Atta, April 1996, sat in his small Hamburg, Germany apartment, writing out his last will and testament. He was 27, an architecture student at Technical University, the son of an affluent Cairo lawyer, fluent in German and living comfortably in one of the most affluent societies on earth. Nothing in his circumstance compelled him to dwell on death. He was educated, again, affluent, and already planning his martyrdom.
Sure sounds like he was a member of the oppressed, right?
Not at all, actually.
Yeah.
He even gave detailed instructions for the handling of his corpse. He did not want any woman to go to his grave at all or be at his funeral or on any occasion thereafter. He wanted to be wrapped in three white pieces of unadorned cloth, laid on his right side facing Mecca and buried next to good Muslims. I wanted to make sure he was not buried in any place where infidels lied. After all, he was planning to kill them. Why? That's what Allah prescribed. He was very clear about that. His money was to be divided according to the Muslim religion, as Almighty God has asked us to do. Tablet continues, there was no political program, no mention of foreign policy or economic grievances in the document. There was only a young Muslim man in a German apartment arranging to sacrifice his life to Allah in the confidence that Allah would reward his martyrdom in the life to come. The document is among the most neglected pieces of evidence from 9/11 because it contradicts the explanations of the attack that most Western commentators preferred. Atta was not poor. He was not radicalized by drone strikes that had not yet happened, nor by American support for Israel. He never mentioned Israel. He was not in any formal or organizational sense an Islamist. Rather, he was just an uncompromising Muslim. Yet for 25 years, Western elites repeatedly insisted that men like Atta must have been driven by something other than the culture and the faith that provided him with the lens through which his actions seemed to him both sensible and necessary. After 9/11, intellectuals, still going on today, after 9/11, intellectuals and policymakers ask, what went wrong? As though the source of Atta's animus toward the West was shrouded in some deep mystery. It wasn't. It was shrouded in his religion. You can see that from his writings. What followed is a 25-year campaign, Lee, of Western elites insisting that men like Muhammad Atta were driven by something other than their culture and their faith. American leaders then added a second layer of denial. President George W. Bush stood at the Islamic Center of Washington to insist that the face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. Following Bush's lead and after later atrocities in Paris, Brussels, Manchester, and elsewhere, Western leaders repeatedly said that the killers had nothing to do with Islam. That's where we are. You know, what's interesting, Lee, is to do this historically, because these last 25 years were not the first time we did this. Deliberately misunderstood. It's just in the past, Lee, we learned faster.
Mm-hmm.
Love this article, Jihad in the Days of Jefferson.
Yeah.
So for all of you who like to say, well, you know, our founding fathers, they were isolationists and they never... Really? Go read about the Barbary Pirates.
Yeah.
Victory in Tripoli. That's not in the continental United States.
But it's in the Marines hymn there.
Yeah. And it talks about, I love this part. Okay, it's May 1786. And, our merchants are being kidnapped, sold as slaves. Ransom demanded for them. And this is the interesting part. May 1786, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, then both diplomats in Europe, met with Tripoli's ambassador to London. And they were trying to understand, why did the North Africans attack ships of a country, America, that had done nothing to provoke such hostility? The two asked. And they listed, going all the way back to the Crusades, other, you know, countries, nations that had conflicted with Muslims and with people of those areas, and said, look, we've never attacked you. Why won't you leave us alone? Why are you doing this? The response was unnerving. As Adams and Jefferson later reported to the Continental Congress, the ambassador said the raids were a jihad against infidels. Just flat out told them. Muslim privateers felt it was, quote, their duty to make war upon non-Muslims wherever they could be found and to make slaves of all they could as prisoners, and that every Muslim should be slain in battle because then he was sure to go to paradise. It was further explained that if you came into contact with infidels, essentially, Lee, that it would be a sin to let them pass. The Americans now had two choices, pay tribute or fight the pirates. And we know how that is.
Yeah.
We fought. And that's that line, you know, from the shores of Tripoli.
Yeah.
The Barbary states at the time, they comprised what is now modern day North Africa. But this is the history of America. It is the actual history of America. We may wish it isn't, and it wasn't, but it is. And so Adams and Jefferson came back and reported to the Continental Congress that, look, this is jihad. It's not going to stop. And they made the decision not to pay the ransom.
Which was the right call at that time and still would be today.
Yeah. So fast forward to today, as we're still doing it, we still don't understand. Yeah. We still don't get, we refuse to understand. And we have potentially this fall, we have now gotten to the point where not one, but two candidates, one for Senate, who's a Democrat, and one for the House, are either directly funded by known terror organizations or those who run them, or worked for them. We have Adam Hamawi, who has won his Democrat primary in New Jersey. He worked for the Benevolent Society in Bosnia, a designated terror group of the U.S. Treasury and the U.N. Worked there. And when he wasn't doing that, he was driving the blind sheikh around. During the period, by the way, he was planning the first attack on the World Trade Center. Killed six, by the way, including a pregnant woman. He was a character witness for the blind sheikh at his trial. Tried to save him, but didn't work out. He's blind sheikh still in prison. He drove him as his personal driver throughout the Middle East and also throughout the United States of America. And he will probably be sworn into the next Congress as a member of Congress.
It's not the enemy at the gate. It's the enemy in the gate.
Yeah. And then you have El Said, who I have a tweet out about him now. When you look at who his sponsors are, now, a lot of money for his campaign is being funneled in by his mother and his father-in-law, both of whom worked or work for designated terror organizations. These are terror funding organizations. They provided funding for Hamas and Al-Qaeda. He's just run for Congress, like, no big deal. Go be in the Senate. I don't even know how you give these people security clearances. I don't know what they're doing on our soil. Jefferson would have slapped us across the face and said, well, what are you doing? And we just can't see it. And I don't know what it is about Western culture, but it's, oh, well, you know, we'll look inward and see what we, you know, in some cases, it's not us. Wish we could change it. Can't. So that's where we are. Meanwhile, we still have John Thune refusing to end funding for the Taliban in the Senate. I mean, so it's not just on the Democrat side, to be fair. It's on the Republican side, too. And God bless her, Nancy Mace, along with Tim Burchett, several other Republicans, have twice passed a bill that has passed the House, blocked in the Senate, stuck in committee to end the roughly $40 million a month that we still give the Taliban to keep them in power. For reasons I don't know. I don't, no idea. Someone should ask John Thune. By the way, he denied knowing about it, but then was forced to admit that he is funding the Taliban and said he's not going to take the bills up. So don't know why we love the Taliban now, I guess. But it's a good day to remind folks that around 2,500 U.S. service members died in Afghanistan.
Thank you for listening to Red Meat, collection of conservative audio from Odyssey's talk stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in, listen wherever you get podcasts, and smash that subscribe button.